many, many people trying to start up their own business ventures. Would you say it was an entrepreneurial atmosphere?
That was
before
the big surge in that direction. No, there were some, but not many. The one person, I'll call another case, a fellow named John Bishop, came in one day in my office in South Pasadena. I had never heard of him. He's a graduate from the Harvard Business School, and he said Beckman Institute was one of the case studies they used. And he was innocent, wondering if we had a job for him. But I was quite impressed by the guy, that, so we hired him. And he stayed with us for many years. He's still now, he left later on and set up his own business, in which he's been successful, but we're close friends. That's another case. But he makes electronic amplifiers, and I think from time to time we have purchased things from him.
When did he first come to you, approximately?
I want to say we're in South Pasadena, which means it was after 41 and before 54, because 54 he moved to Fullerton. He had been there several years, so it was in the late 40s or middle of the late 40s.
So by then Beckman Instruments was catching the eye of someone in the Harvard business.
Now, here was a case where I brought him in and put him in charge of the department. What we call electronic specialist, I think was his division. Anyway, he was responsible for that, so he did his own hiring and all this and that. He ran. My method of operation was that I wanted to keep small units. I felt that there's an advantage in flexibility and keeping that. So we split up our into different divisions away from the very earliest days, and gave a lot of authority to the managers of those divisions. We had the Hewlett-Packard division and the Spector division, and then Jack Bishop got us into computers, analog computers, built that up.
Were you, I'm going now into the post-the war and the post-war period, that as the business was expanding very rapidly, were you reading business textbooks in your spare time, or were you operating intuitively in...
operating intuitively. No, I've never studied any books on management, never any course in management. So I just, as I say, learned the hard way from making mistakes. Now, this is hard to describe, and I hate to say this being a public own, because shareholders might think, what the hell is Beckman doing there if he's not business-oriented? I really am not business-oriented. I do look at balance sheets and P&L statements and know what you have to have, but the fun, the harder thing is in the technical aspects. I know I have to have this thing be financially successful, but that's for the controller, not that to worry about. I'm concerned more about solving a technical problem, coming up with something that's useful for advancement of science. It's that aspect of it that predominates.
Well, if Beckman Instruments is a very vivid example of the way in which brilliant ideas are paramount in the long haul, I want to ask you a little bit by way of philosophic digression, but there's been a lot of commentary and discussion in recent days about the short-term orientation of American business and the quarterly and semi-annually and annual reporting.
That, I think, is the one consequence of the emphasis on the schools of business administration. And this is one of the serious problems of business. They look at the short term, the quarterly reports, or even monthly reports, the quarterly reports, and it's hard for a manager, a CEO, to resolutely look at the long range and suffer the consequences of adverse short-term results. And this is, I think, being realized more and more now by some businesses, but we went through a period where, in fact, our own company has gone through that, where we look at the monthly reports and get all concerned if one group is up or one group is down, something like that. You know? I think that our business generally is beginning to realize that we have to have the long-range goals in mind.
How does that carry implications for the way people are educated? What is it that we should be doing?
Well, I'll tell you a story that General Doriot told me. Remember him? He founded the Harvard Business School. And he said, one problem we have here is that our graduates feel they're a failure in life if they aren't vice president at least 2 or 3 years after on the job. He told a story about one of the graduates who was called into the office of the president of his company one day. Said, John, I said, I want you to know that I'm going to make you a vice president as of today. John just didn't say anything, on just put one foot in the other. Said, John, is he here? You're vice president of the company now. And I said, you haven't got anything? Well, thanks, Dad. Well, so Doria was aware of this thing too, that the Harvard Business School guys came out, they thought they were a somewhat superior breed of people. And they were, well, but business training is only part of it. There's understanding of employees, motivations, and things like that, things that, that at least in many schools of administration, are not emphasized, the human factors. So early on, I was lucky to have employee relations manager like Don Strauss, for example, who's grown over the years, and it's paid off. We don't have any unions. We've had 15 union elections over the history of the company, and our employees have turned union down every time when they're, because I feel happy about this, because I think when employees feel they have to have unions to represent them, management has somehow been negligent in coming up with things. So we try to give all the benefits and provide a work atmosphere that employees are happy, and they are. We have these annual service award banquets, you know, and I'm amazed each time how many long service employees we have, and that's proof of the long range aspects of running the business on there. It's very expensive, actually, to lose an employee. See, after all, any employee, no matter what his background, learns a lot, has to be taught a lot on the job. And when he leaves, you lose all that experience. So that's one reason why we like to hang on to our long-term employees.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. These questions of entrepreneurship and versus management technique are very interesting, and
but they're not complicated. I speak now, having no training in business administration, so I can be naive. But I think what it is merely being honest. Be honest with yourself first of all, and then honest with the employer. I'll give an example. Now, just last week, 2 weeks ago, one of our alumni, Elder Ardson, she lives over in Honolulu now. She's with us for 24 years. She came back, and after she'd been out for several years, she came back, came to the plant, and brought Lay's back for me and for Don Strauss. She was just in love with the place. And she had tears when she left. She had to go with. Well, that's the sort of attitude we get. It's a family affair and a loyalty that you can't buy, and you can't generate it by phony techniques. There has to be an empathy there, and I think part of it is that we try to be all the same way. When I go out on the factory floor, I talk to anybody. I'm glad to talk to them. There's no status symbol. Well, he's the number one guy, the next number two guy, number three. None of that. We have to have lines of authority, of course, to do it, but everybody can get the boss's attention. Over the years, I used to talk to employees from time to time when we were modest size. So, and here again, I said, naive, no doubt, but I told them the thing to do is to do your best. I said, you're going to make mistakes. If you don't make mistakes, I'm going to come to you're not doing much. Because making mistakes is part of the job of being there. And I said, there's one thing, though, one kind of mistake there not be accepted, and that is a mistake based on any kind of dishonesty or lack of integrity. And I said, the one thing you must not do is ever do anything that makes me ashamed to walk into any of our users' offices and like that. You can make mistakes, but they have to be honest, legitimate mistakes. So that's the philosophy, and they've got that too. And our users know that too. They know they can depend on us, regardless of whether it's a hard and fast written agreement. If something's wrong, something like that, we correct it. And we go in over the years. For example, we give a year's warranty on our instruments. If an instrument fails within a year, we repair it at our expense. Well, that means that puts a pressure on our employees to come up with high quality, because that it's very costly to go out in the field and repair an instrument. So we, our employees feel a necessity of maintaining the highest quality in the construction of the instrument and in the design too.
When you were making the decision to leave Caltech and to go full time with this venture, did you have what would now be called any role models, any people that you said, well, X has done this and I admire him and the way he has done it, and these things that you're talking about, like the integrity of in the organization?
No, I don't recall any role model that anyone has put in. It's built up gradually, and finally got to the point where in 39 they say somebody had to run the show full time, and it was a case of whether I tried to do that or whether I went out and hired a professional to do it. And that was a very difficult decision to make, because at that time the Caltech, particularly the chemistry department, was pure science oriented. The scientists looked down a little bit on anybody working in applied science or something like that, and particularly anything that savored of commercialism was frowned on. That's why I was careful. None of the pH meter development was tied into Caltech. It had nothing to do with my research. It is a little different from the present burst in entrepreneurship we see in the whole genetic engineering field. So the pH meter, as I mentioned earlier, was just a chance development that I did a favor for Glenn Joseph. My own research was quantum theory of photochemical reaction. It had nothing to do with pH. So I kept it out entirely on there. But nevertheless, I felt even my name, if I went out and called a Beckman instrument when I'm still on the faculty at Caltech, there might be some in a place. So it's only when I decided to separate entirely from Caltech that I changed then from National Technical Laboratories to Beckman Instruments. And saying that was a tough decision, because I enjoyed my association with Caltech, and also I had a little feeling, which is an extension of this attitude of the pure scientist, that anybody engaged in commercialism was somehow a sort of a second level citizen on here. And it was a really tough decision made. Over the years, though, I thought also, am I, as I say, prostituting my scientific training by leaving academia and going into industry? Well, I've overcome that over the years by many friends say, well, you've done more for science by making thousands of instruments available for others than you would have done with your own two hands in a laboratory. Well, I hope they're right. I don't argue with them too strongly on that.
Well, that shows your good judgment once again.
But no, it's having no business training, a lot of things I didn't do in an ordinary way, but I looked on business pretty the same way I'd look on research. You encounter problems, they're tough problems, you wonder how to solve them, and you learn pretty soon the thing to do is to break the problem down into components if you can, finally get small enough pieces that you know how to attack that. Well, it's true whether it's a financial problem or whether it's a technical problem or whatnot. Break the problem. Well, first of all, I go back and I learned that the most important thing probably is to recognize what the problem is. Because it's so easy to think you know the problem, and you start to solve that and you find out that's not really the problem after all, it's something else. So I stress that. Be sure you know what the problem is before you start attacking. Then when you get it, then break it down into pieces and solve your individual pieces and you get on with the work. Mm-hmm. And coupled with absolute integrity. I'm speaking not now of a financial thing, but intellectual integrity. Don't kid yourself. Don't allow yourself to be the victim of wishful thinking. Those two are the fundamentals of my concept of how to run a business.
Just to stay on allied themes for one moment more, and then we'll go back into some of the technical areas. I'm sure that out there in chemistry and engineering classes in college students today, there are numerous chemists, chemical engineers, thinking that, well, that one day they'd like to be pioneering their own business. What would you say to them in terms of training, out of the light of your own experience?
Well, first of all, I think they should get trained in the areas of science or engineering that they're interested in. They must have the competence, first of all. And then I say they must have some level of common sense. It's so easy to get this come back again, to engage in wishful thinking. Think you've got something and picture yourself. That's the dangerous thing. You have to be realistic in the approach. And that involves such things, for example, if a person has an idea, thinks they can commercialize, is there a market there? What's the competitive? Just some of the common sense things you do anyway. A person has to go through that step. Oh, there are sort of practical things. I've seen many small companies fail because they utilize their initial capital, which is usually small, in the wrong ways. They'll fix up a good office, they'll spend it on typewriters and desks and things like that. They'll use up all their capital in non-productive things instead of using it for working capital for doing. And it's amazing how often that phenomenon appears. They want to put on a prestigious front on there. Well, we didn't, and I think that's a mistake. We started in a tin shed, you know, and gradually build up. So make use of your available working capital, whatever it is, in the extent you can, in producing something that has a profit attached to it.
Well, that gets us back to the next question I wanted to ask about the technical matters. In developing the DU, I gather you must have financed that out of earnings from the pH meter. Is that how it was?
That's right.
And when a year or so later, when you began working on the IR-1 and the helipod, which were more or less simultaneous, did the money for that come from the contracts from the government? You must have had to do more development work and put on more production.
No, we didn't have development contracts. These were selling the products. No, this was in the day. This wasn't in the good old days where the government said, here's a lot of money to go and do something. No.
There was production contracts.
Even on the helipod, for example, which is strictly government, the government didn't give us $1 for development. Oh. They said, we'll buy the things from you when you get them. Mm-hmm. So we had to absorb all that development cost out of our accumulated earnings from pH meters.
Did the cost of the contract cover your cost of gearing up to meet this vastly expanded production?
Not in that era. Later on, as we became a little more sophisticated, mm-hmm. we got the government to put up money, or even private company, for example. Later on, we got IBM to put in $700,000 to build a plant for us so we could make more little resistive devices for them. But that's after we got a little more sophisticated, but we didn't ever have these grants from NIH or things like that in those early days. This is purely our own money was being risked. Matter of fact, we weren't alone in them. The whole trend of industrial development changed during the war. Mm-hmm. See, when the war came on, well, here there was an urgency on the part of the government, and they then became much more generous and were willing to put money into these things.
You started to tell us earlier about getting involved in the infrared developments with the synthetic rubber project. Could you tell us again about how that came about, how you were invited to the Detroit meeting in 1945?
The Office of Rubber Reserve, there's Oliver I'll think of the name.
Yes, we'll track it down.
The one person in charge there, and he was the one who called this conference and said we had Bratton was there and Barnes was there and others. And at this decision, the officer of reserve made the decision to, first of all, use infrared techniques, and second was they thought that Bob Bratton's design was the one to go, and that was a single beam thing, and very, very crude, had no relation to an infrared. It was the parts assembled on a surface plate, you know, this to get a flat, heavy surface on there.
Here's a description of the.
Yeah, that was 41. Yeah, I don't remember. I've forgotten this article. I probably read it on here, but well, how they adopted this, I don't know. Bob Bratton was an aggressive person, but he was pretty well convinced that what he was doing was the right thing, and imagine he conveyed this impression. Yeah, there it is. It's all laid out on a flat base on here, and had the advantage of being on a. Of course, we had masses, enough weight there that it wasn't so susceptible to motion by displacement by vibration, and also these are all freely located. You see, they could move them around, just fasten down to the base. So that was the advantage on them. I recall a detail also that. He had a straight slit, well, one of the things we put in, we curved the slit so we could get a little higher resolution out of the thing. And, we made 100 of these things, I recall, was the order that we got from Officer Rubber Reserve.
And the machine that Bowling Barnes and Van Zandt Williams had built at American Cyanamid around the same time, where they were. They had the problem of analyzing butane and isobutane mixtures.
Yeah.
Used a, it had the thermocouple output was tied to a deflecting galvanometer, so that the output was then photographically recorded from the galvanometer beam. And it occurred to me that one way of making the output, and this is something, in fact, that Barnes and Williams mentioned in an article. One way of making the output. More accurate, or recording it more accurately, was to get some kind of photoelectric mechanism in there, which was the same problem that you faced with Glenn Joseph and the pH meter, wasn't it?
Well, this we used a galvanometer on this. Mm-hmm. Legion Arthur HS galvanometer with an optical beam, one meter scale out there, and that was mm-hmm. the recording thing on this too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the same mm-hmm. problem though. How are you going to measure electrical output down in the 10th to minus 8th, 9th mm-hmm. ampere region on there.
Mm-hmm. Did you eventually design it so that you could use an electronic amplifier in the circuit? Was that during...
We had the amplifiers mm-hmm. in our pH meter mm-hmm. parallel at this time, and so that then later on when we realized this is a good way of measuring the output of a photocell, that was applied then to this. Mm-hmm.
To the IR as well as
IR.
The DU.
Yeah.
Was that during the war, or would that have been after the war?
Well, that was 41, 42 during the war.
Yeah, I see. The visible and UV spectroscopy community. But IR was a newer technique, wasn't it? At least as far as using it for analytical purposes.
Yeah, that was used to extend the range. See, the quartz prism, the DU, would wear in the near ultraviolet and near infrared. But this extended the infrared range out. Much farther.
Yeah. Had you and the other people working with you had contact with Barnes and Van Zandt Williams and Dudley Williams and Norman Wright and some
yeah.
of the other people working on IR spectroscopy at that time?
Yes, there were meetings at technical mm-hmm. conventions and things like that. And in this, of course, there's a rather ironical situation. See, Bowling Barnes. This was a double beam instrument. Ours is a single beam. That's clear. Well, Bowling Barnes, we're pretty cocky about and proud of ourselves having got the contract for this thing. Well, that was a very costly contract from the standpoint that our users were all subject to secrecy classifications. They were not allowed to publish themselves. Bowling Barnes users were not. So he could go out and sell to the general public. And so he did sell. And so, and these people could publish. So the literature then, for a period of two or three, several years in there, until the end of the war, in fact, was entirely related to the use of the Bowling Barnes instrument. Meantime, why, people didn't know. We'd actually made more spectrophotometers than Bowling Barnes had, but there was nothing in the literature. And so we had one heck of a sales problem when the war was over, because all the literature for that, and you know, people wanted to use new instruments, refer back to the literature, what did so-and-so use? Well, it was a Barnes instrument. So we had an uphill battle for years. In fact, one time we had to make a decision. Are we going to be in the infrared business or not? So I made the decision that, yes, we're going to be the leader in the infrared field. So we spent a tremendous amount of money on development and subsequent models of infrared spectrums that have come along. But this was, a business matter that we didn't anticipate when we got this.
Barnes went to Perkin-Elmer right after the war, and I guess it was Perkin-Elmer instruments that you're talking about. Did they also sell through the dealers, or did they have their own sales force at that time?
They had their own sales force, but they sold through some dealers also.
So it was, in a sense, they were competing for your prime market, which was the dealers, who then...
Another factor began to be recognized on here, that dealers, by and large, were not able to handle sophisticated instruments. They could handle a balance or something like that, but when you come to a spectrophotometer, that involved more expertise than their salesmen really had. So that the more costly, more sophisticated instruments really were not suitable for dealer handling. That was being recognized, I think, by Perkin-Elmer. There were some sales in there, but it was sort of a vague gray area.
When do you think that problem really began to be recognized? Was it already emerging before World War II, or was it a problem that really grew under the conditions of war?
I don't think it had really anything to do much with the war. It was the nature of the instruments. And say they could handle a pH meter because they had a little portable thing, and if you had a service call, it worked, you could put the instrument up, take it back to the shop. You couldn't do that with a spectrophotometer. That's when you had to have then a trained service force. That was, I can't pinpoint very well in years, but it was when instruments of this degree of sophistication began to be used that the need for trained service people began to be recognized. And a few dealers, such as Arthur H. Thomas, did provide these trained people, but many dealers didn't. And when anything went wrong, they blamed the manufacturer, even though they were given a very substantial discount to provide that service. They weren't doing it. They say, well, the manufacturers had fallen on here. So that was one of the reasons, say, that began to be a very costly situation, and we realized we had to change.
Yes. This was all in the background of your 1960 decision.
Yeah, that's right. This is just a photo we had of the innards of the IR-1.
IR-1, yeah.
And that gives us, one can see visually how it is a much more complicated instrument than some of the earlier ones.
And this had just quite a great big sheet-iron cover over it, you know.
We do want to keep going for another hour, and in the interest of not getting too tired, I wonder if it might make sense to take a five-minute break. Just pause for a minute or two, put the air conditioner back on for a minute or two, and then do a second session. All right.